Hello, and welcome to Failing Boldly, a podcast that invites people to share stories about failure, resilience, and perseverance. I'm Christian Kuhn, author of the book Failing Boldly and pastor of Urban Village Church in Chicago. My guest for this week's podcast is Robert Schnazy, bishop of the Rio, Texas Conference in the United Methodist Church. Bishop Schnazy has been a bishop since 2004 and is also author of many popular books in the church world, including Five Practices of Fruitful Congregations and Just Say Yes, Unleashing People for Ministry. I should also add that Bishop Schnazy was gracious enough to write the foreword to my own book. In this conversation, he talks about his own beginnings in ministry and how failure has played a role in his vocation. I hope you enjoy it. Well, thank you, Bishop, once again for joining me on this podcast. And to begin, I was just wondering if you could share a little bit about your own upbringing and the importance of faith in your life. And then also, how old were you when the whole idea of ministry kind of first entered your mind?
Sure. So I was actually born in a German Lutheran family, but inactive. I was baptized as an infant in a Lutheran church, but my family was fairly inactive in church until they moved to an area that didn't in south along the border of Texas, South Texas border with Mexico, that didn't have a Lutheran church, and they started attending a Methodist church. And so about the third grade is my earliest memories of church, and we attended a congregation, First United Methodist Church in Del Rio, Texas, that just kind of surrounded us with love, helped us grow in faith. My family kind of step by step got more involved until it reached a point where my kind of youth involvement was pulling the family even closer into the church. So it's like because the youth program reached me, it helped draw my parents into more active participation in the church. My earliest memories of thinking about the call to ministry go back to kind of early to mid-teen years. We had a visiting evangelist Cornelius Henderson was his name. He went on to become a bishop, but he preached a sermon that just kind of called me out and made me kind of think differently about the whole matter of faith. And then I had a pastor. I was gifted enough to have a pastor who took seriously this notion of an outward call to ministry and who invited me into to various leadership roles and ministry roles and then at one point preached a sermon, "Are You Called to Ministry?" and handed me a brochure with that same title and said, "I'd like you to just think about that." And that's when I kind of had the effect of drawing the connections of my life experiences together. I compare the call to ministry like stars in the sky that someone point out the constellation, and then suddenly you can see the shape of it. So I had all these little experiences, and he's the first person that described that as a call to ministry for me. Mm-hmm. So that's some of my background. I entered college, not sure what I was going to do, but thinking seriously about ministry. And after just a couple of years, determined that was the direction I was going. And so entered seminary when I was about 21 and kind of haven't looked back.
Yeah. So I'm always curious for folks who go, well, to any vocation, but certainly the ministry, when you first enter your first appointment. And also, I'm curious, too, if this was true when you first started as a bishop, when you would have days early on when you would think to yourself, what have I gotten myself into?
Well, that that continues to this day. So I think that's just part of the call to ministry is wrestling with doubts. As a matter of fact, it raises a red flag to me when I'm talking to someone about their call to ministry. If it's just, I'm absolutely sure and there's no question. I mean, all the call stories in Scripture have the person saying, "No, I'm too young, I'm too this, I'm too, you know, Moses, you know, I can't speak." Everybody had excuses and doubts and questions. And which they had to overcome or by faith kind of move through. And so I think that's just a part of almost everybody's call to ministry. Now, as far as, arriving on the job and what in the world have I gotten myself into, that began, I mean, almost day one for me. Hmm. And it both in pastoral ministry as well as a bishop. I was assigned to a church right out of seminary where it was a church that didn't pay its apportionment, didn't even have it in the budget, had a pretty long history of decline, had a staffing situation which was just bizarre, and then had some folks around me in kind of critical leadership who basically, you know, were such control folks and so negative that it was just kind of hard to ever get a footing. And so it took a good deal of persistence and at some point courage and then recklessness to start experimenting with things. realizing that I was going to have to work around the system to kind of get things started rather than working through. So as a for instance, I learned early on that if I was going to start a new young adult Sunday school class back in the day or something like that, or going through the education, Christian education work area, the Council of Ministries, the Administrative Board, and who knows what other seven committees, it would just never get there. Mm-hmm. But if I just invited three couples over to our home and we picked up a book and started reading through it and did it every 2 weeks, I could start something. And so I learned early on that you have to work around, you have to be willing to take risks. A lot of those things don't work, but I could not have been effective in ministry had I just done what came to me and was placed on my desk each Monday and just worked my way through it. And the same was true as a bishop. I was appointed to a conference, in the Missouri conference, 13 years ago. They'd had a lawsuit that had been winding through the courts for 6 or 7 years and came to culmination in my first few months with a judgment against the conference that exceeded the assets of the annual conference. So you talk about starting from behind.
Yeah.
And having to build trust, having to realign resources and so forth. That was a very challenging experience. Now, what's interesting, to looking back on it, I wouldn't wish that experience on anybody, but I learned never to waste a crisis. And that lawsuit drew attention and got people's attention in the conference more than losing 80,000 members over the previous 40 years ever did.
Yeah.
It suddenly put our existence on the line and gave me as a leader the benefit of the doubt to really take aggressive action to change up all kinds of aspects of the conference. And so that's an example of something that was, just an awful experience. But it turned out to be, I think, one of the foundational experiences that helped us do some of the creative things we eventually did in Missouri.
Yeah. I appreciate when you're talking about your pastoral ministry and talking about having the courage and also you use the word recklessness, you didn't say spirit of recklessness, but I appreciate that too. And I get that from your books. I'm wondering, you talked about it at Missouri when there was you didn't want to waste that crisis. Have there been a time or two at least that you can share where there was, I don't know if crisis is the right word, but when you lived into having the courage and maybe being a little reckless and things just went awry and and you felt like I failed here. And then how you responded out of that.
Yeah. Well, it's, you know, you're asking some challenging questions to get folks to think about their failures. Mm-hmm. And yet we could look at this in almost any aspect of life. If any of us, you know, who've raised children wanted to focus on failures, we'd see, you know, setbacks, aspects of their personality or their habits or something, and say, boy, where'd I go wrong?
Yeah.
If any of us looks at our pension fund or our savings, we say, what was I thinking 15 years ago or 20 years ago? Why didn't I make different decisions? Any of us that visits the doctor and, you know, gets the report on our cholesterol or our health, I mean, if we focus on all the ways we're failing, it can become just this kind of downward spiral.
Yeah.
And I think a lot of things that we call failure, it's kind of failure from our point of view because we had a set of expectations that were not met. Mm-hmm. And instead of and many of these things that we kind of call failure or feel like failure are almost more like life cycle things of particular programs or ministries. So is it a failure if you try to start a new worship service and you were expecting 75 people to attend and only 40 attend?
Mm-hmm.
Well, you can second guess yourself. We should have started later. We should have changed the time. We have the wrong mix of music. Maybe. So there's things to learn through that experience, but you've got 40 people there.
Yeah. Yeah.
And, you know, none of the churches that Paul wrote his letters to are still in existence. Did he fail at those, or did they run their cycle? You know, when I think of some of the decisions that I've made, and here I'm going to go back to pastoral ministry rather than bishop. Some of those were staff issues. Doing great work and due diligence and thinking I've got this all lined up and bringing someone on staff that within 3 days I'm thinking, uh-oh, what the world was I thinking? you know, my biggest failure with staff usually has been keeping someone on too long who needed to be let go.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not talking about people who were doing real harm. That would have been interrupted sooner. But there's a host of kind of even kind of staff, day-to-day operational things that I look back and wish had been done differently. On the other hand, all of those were learning experiences.
Yeah.
All of those were preparing me for another level of ministry, another level of complexity. I can't imagine getting from here to there without those experiences. It's sometimes it feels like the wilderness journey,
yeah.
but it takes that to get from here to there. And you know, back to your comment about recklessness, I think the fear of failure becomes just paralyzing for so many pastors. It's it restrains creativity. It restrains productivity. It blocks imagination, and somehow we got to. I mean, some of this we just can look back at our source documents at scriptures, and all the stories that Jesus tells that have some element of things not going right. Whether it's, you know, the sower sowing the seed, you know, three quarters of that gets wasted.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And, you know, choked by weeds and eaten by birds and stuff. I think that was that's a parable that prompts us to risk. The story of the talents, same thing. There's this constant, you know, go for it. I mean, he sent these disciples out two by two to a place they'd never been before with a message they were yet unfamiliar with, to situations that were antagonistic to the message, and they needed a kind of spiritual courage and recklessness to go do that.
Yeah.
And then when they came back, that's when he tells the parable of the sower.
Yeah.
To help them wrestle with discouragement.
I think you're, in fact, I wrote down on my, one of the questions I was going to ask, and you took it right off of my sheet of paper here, that fear can be, fear of failure can be paralyzing for folks. And I think in general, too, especially for people who are new into the ministry, they want to do all the right things, and so they don't want to mess up. But I wonder, too, do you sense that with the decades-long story of denominational decline, does that exacerbate this fear of failure? Like we can't risk anything because we're already in decline. Or are you finding that some people are saying, you know what, we've got to try something new, so let's be a little reckless and failure is going to happen. So where is your sense, and at least in your own context, okay, where we are with that?
So the churches I served as a pastor, you would look back at those and you would say those were successful pastorates in terms of the numerical elements of success and that kind of thing. And yet, as I was moving forward during my early ministry and then for 16 years at First Church McAllen, I would have described myself as a fairly organizationally conservative and cautious and yet kind of persistent. I was always putting a little pressure to move forward. Mm. What's the next idea? How do we expand this? How do we improve that? But it wasn't, you know, radical change part. Mm-hmm. When I became a bishop and began to look at the United Methodist Church from kind of 30,000 feet and step into a conference that was just like all, just about every other conference, as I said, lost 80,000 members over a 40-year period, I feel like that's when I became a high-stakes gambler. Mm. that I moved out of that a little bit more cautious, let's just take one little step at a time, and moved into the just say yes attitude and profile. That if an idea aligned with the mission, if there were champions for the cause that did good background on whether this was a good decision. If there was a source of funding for it, it's like, give it a try.
Yeah.
So the decline of the mainline denomination has actually, to me, helped feed some of the most creative responses. Mm. We've got to talk about doing church differently. We've got to get church out of the building. We've got to look at not one, two, or three models of starting new faith communities, but 12, 15 mm-hmm. ways of starting new faith communities. We've got to entrust younger adults who have a call to ministry and clarity about the mission and purpose of the church, but maybe don't have the credentials that we would normally expect. We've got to set them free to go ahead and start faith communities, and then the credentialing, we'll get mm-hmm. to that when we get to that.
Yeah.
I mean, I feel like it's precisely because of our decline that we've got to take a more assertive stance and become more embrace risk more easily. You know, you look at us as United Methodists and that language of our heritage. I mean, the word Methodist, it speaks of everything being done in a methodical way.
Right.
Discipline. The general rules of Wesley. I mean, just think about how stodgy that all sounds.
Right.
And yet you look at John Wesley himself, and he was just an absolute, continuous innovator.
Yeah.
You know, using lay speakers, crossing parish lines, developing bands and classes and societies, ordaining people and sending them to America. He was constantly kind of pushing the limit, and a whole lot of things didn't work.
Yeah.
I mean, you look in the early days of the Methodist movement, whatever happened to the Huntingdon connection?
Mm.
Well, it had a few chapels and then died away. And yet that was something that he was related to. And so I think we, in mainline denominations, if we're going to see at some point a turning around. It's going to require us to change a lot of things pretty radically, and with that is means we're going to have to experiment a lot, and there's going to be a number of things that are not going to work.
Yeah, one of the things I really appreciated from your book was I mentioned to you before we started recording that I bought the Kindle version and typed in the word failure, and it popped up 17 times in your book, which pleased me to no end. And one of the quotes in there, and you used this really great phrase, to be failure-tolerant leaders. And one of the things you wrote in the book was, without failure-tolerant leaders, pastors won't feel free to experiment. Are you hopeful that there's an increase of failure-tolerant leaders on all levels, both in our denomination but in other spaces too?
Well, I don't know that there's an increase or decrease. I think those who are strongly risk-averse, those churches are becoming fewer and fewer. They're declining and dying. So it's, I say in the book, Just Say Yes, that growing churches have figured out how to say yes to ideas that dying churches have said no to. You could almost say the same thing, that growing churches take risks that declining churches refuse to take. And so I feel like a part of my role as a bishop is to help cultivate and protect, kind of put a little buffer around those who are taking, who are experimenting and taking risks, but not doing that carelessly.
Right.
Who are doing that conscientiously, and yet in a way that may draw criticism. Part of the role of leaders protecting those folks. And I think that's true for pastors and local congregations too. Somebody new joins the church, perhaps has no church background. There's a need that they felt in their own life, whether it be about some element of recovery or drug or alcohol or divorce, or they've seen something in their life where people are hurting. And they just suddenly have this new idea for ministry, and they can't understand the stodginess of the system that doesn't respond to it. Well, part of the role of the pastor for that person is to become a buffer, to protect them from all that would restrain, so that they have a little space to at least experiment with this ministry, to give it a try. So I think we need more of that. I think we need more.
That's a really good, a helpful thing to lift up too, in for clergy leaders or any lay leaders, if they feel like, as a reminder for them that yes, that they should be having a spirit of innovation, which may lead to risk, which may lead to failure, but they're not the only ones. That there are folks in their faith communities who may also have a seed of innovation and risk and failure. And so to also be aware and open and looking out for them, and as you noted, to give them a buffer to do these things. I'm going to quote you one more time out of your book as a way maybe to kind of close this up. Christ's ministry requires our willingness to risk failure. I would imagine that that's one thing, especially for newer clergy, that you've tried to convey to them. And so I guess that would be my last question is, how are you advising clergy of all ages, but especially for younger clergy, as they go into their ministries and contexts around risk-taking and innovation?
Yes. Well, I think clergy of all different ages that are thinking about new ideas, or they either something has come to them, or they notice an unmet need in their in the mission field right around them, and so they often have either a discernment or kind of convicted by the Holy Spirit that we need to do something about this, and then the word fear will come into the conversation. But I'm afraid that, and what I like to explore with folks are just, what are they afraid of? And one possibility is the fear of failure, that that will give some time and resources to this, and no one will show up, or it won't have the intended effect. I think that's where we've got to make failure our friend and say, you're going to learn something from the experience anyway. Mm. And so don't let that fear of failure stop us from trying bold and audacious things sometimes. On the other hand, when you kind of press the fear thing, often the fear that is even more dominant than the fear of failure is the fear of criticism. Mm. Is the fear that either within our own church or in the larger denomination or our colleagues or something, there are going to be people who say, I disagree, or you're doing it wrong, or any number of things. I told you so. all those kinds of things that that cause us to pause and make us not want to face that criticism. Well, there is not a pastor anywhere who started a new worship service or a new Bible study or a new youth initiative that hasn't had critics within the congregation say, why are you giving your attention to those people over there instead of us over here? Mm-hmm. And I think just part of maturity in ministry is being able to handle the stress of occasionally disappointing people. And yet moving forward kind of nevertheless, learning, hearing legitimate criticism, but not being restrained from kind of just more mindless criticism or mm-hmm. self-serving criticism.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's really helpful. And that criticism, of course, sparks all kinds of internal dialogues that we have with ourselves that can lead us down roads that aren't healthy either for us or for our churches.
Yes.
Yeah, good. Well, Bishop, I greatly appreciate your taking time out of your day. And again, his most recent book is Just Say Yes, Unleashing People for Ministry. And so I hope folks will continue to buy that and explore the Bishop's other books too. And thanks for giving me and listeners some really good things to think about.
Well, sure, and thank you for your good work, not just in congregational leadership, but I think to actually kind of highlight this this element of ministry, to talk about a failure in a open and honest way, instead of just another leadership book about success after success after success, to be able to say, you know, all ministry is two steps forward, one step back.
Yeah.
And then sometimes it's even one step forward, two steps back.
Right.
And that's just the nature of what it is to follow Christ.
Yeah. Amen. Good. All right, Bishop. Thank you again.
Thank you.
That's this week's episode. Thanks again to Robert Schnazy for speaking with me. You can learn about him and all his books at his website, robertschnazy.com. That's S-C-H-N-A-S-E. I hope you'll subscribe to this podcast, as my next conversation is with Matthew Vines, author of the book God and the Gay Christian. And also, if you subscribe to this on iTunes, if you could go on and start reviews for this podcast, that would be helpful too. To learn more about my book and the ministry I'm a part of, you can go to my website, christiankuhn.com. Thanks again for listening.